Hello, and welcome to an all-new episode of 13, the mostly bi-weekly podcast where we ask Colgate community members 13 questions. I'm your host, Daniel DeVries, and today I'm very excited to welcome to the studio the sweet family chair and associate professor of physics and astronomy, Jeff Berry, and the director of research and scholarly initiatives in the university libraries, Josh Fennell, to talk with me a bit about the live music collective here at Colgate. So welcome, both of you, to the studio.
Thanks, Dan, for having us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Absolutely. And I think it's always good to start at the top and tell me a little bit about the live music collective, just in general. What is it?
You want to take it, Jeff?
No, you can take this. Josh.
The Live Music Collective, as we brand ourselves, is, you know, a collective of students, faculty, and staff who are really coming together to bring live music to campus in myriad forms. That's kind of how we describe it. And it takes a lot of different shapes, anywhere from, you know, performances of jazz in the library to performances in town at Flower and Soul and Palace Theater, and then, of course, performances on campus as well. And so it's a really collective effort to bring all of that music, from identifying artists, setting up stages, meeting with bands, and of course, promoting the show itself. That's kind of how I think of the collective. Does that align with you, Jeff?
Yeah, and what I would add to that is just that we've also thought about student performers and giving them opportunities and spaces and places to perform, and potentially opening for some of these touring acts that are the real pros at the moment that are coming through town. And also giving students an opportunity to learn a little bit more about the industry.
Hmm.
You know, so we haven't had a lot of students express that level of interest, but a few who want to know what it's like to book acts and work with agents and to get a better feel for what it's like to be part of the music industry.
Hmm. So can you give me a little insight here, how the physics and astronomy professor got with the library guy and how this all came to be? When did it start, and what was the genesis?
Boy, so the evolution of this goes back to house concerts that my partner Mary Simonson, who's in film media studies and is a trained musicologist, started hosting these semi-regularly, probably about once a semester. And then when we took on the role as faculty directors for Brown Commons, I knew that I wanted live music to be a part of some of the social activities that we did with the students. And we started the Brown Commons Coffee House.
Oh, and when was this?
This was 2017 when we opened up Brown Commons.
Okay.
And three times a semester, we would have a live show, pretty much like one in September, one October, one November, in 110 Broad Street, which was like an old kind of mess hall in an old fraternity house that we turned into a live music venue. And we started with people that we knew, people that we had perform at our house that we felt comfortable having them be guinea pigs. And that was successful enough that we managed to keep doing it. And we were bringing in these touring acts, and some of whom have gone on to be nominated for Grammys and stuff, right, who have performed for audiences as small as like 40 people in 110 Broad Street. And I did that for, was that 5 or 6 years, all the years that I was a director. We did a few remote during the pandemic because that kind of upset everything. And then as I was about to cycle off of being a faculty director, I reached out to Brian. I was like, hey, I've got this idea. We don't need to act on this really quickly, but I don't want to lose all these connections that I had developed with agents and musicians. And I wanted to continue to bring this kind of live music to campus. And Brian was super supportive and was like, you know, I can support you all and give you some of the resources you need to keep this thing going. And so that morphed then from the Brown Commons Coffee House to this, what we think of as a collective of students, faculty, and staff that are organizing these live music opportunities on campus. So my interest and love of live music in particular kind of came about when I was a graduate student in Nashville. Up to that point in my life, I had not really gone to many concerts and was not into bluegrass or old-time music or Americana music at all. But shortly after arriving in Nashville, I started going to a place called the Station Inn. It was mostly a bluegrass venue. I got to see Gillian Welch and David Rawlings play there one night when they were just starting to make a name for themselves, and I was immediately hooked. And then I remember when I was graduating, get my PhD, and they're like, you know, You ain't got to go home, but you can't stay here, kind of thing. And I had to leave Nashville. I was really sad. And one of the things that made me very sad was I was going to miss being able to go once a week to the Station Inn to listen to these just the best bluegrass pickers in the world play. And so I left for there and went to Charlottesville. And Charlottesville had a pretty good music scene, but for me it didn't feel the same as Nashville. And then I left Charlottesville and I came up here, and there wasn't quite the same music scene. You'd have to travel a good hour or two to get to see shows. And when we started those house concerts, it was a little bit of a way for me to kind of connect to this live music that I was missing so much. And then, of course, the Brown Commons Coffee House shows that we started, that was another opportunity for me to kind of fill this void that I was sensing. And so it was that really longing for those days in Nashville of getting to go out almost any day of the week that I wanted to and see incredible live music that really spurred me and pushed me in this direction to get involved with the campus and doing the Brown Commons Coffee House shows, and then, you know, led into the Live Music Collective.
Hmm. And just real briefly for people listening who may not know, can you explain what are the commons?
Oh, yeah. So residential commons are these living learning communities that Colgate instituted starting in 2015, right, with the Mabel Dart. No, it wasn't Mabel Dart. It was Ciccone. Diane Ciccone Commons was the first one. And then a couple years later, Brown Commons and Hancock, I think, came online. And so we have four, and they have faculty directors, and the faculty directors work with the community leaders to develop programming, and we have faculty affiliates that we work with also to develop programming, some a little bit more tilting on the social aspects of life on campus, and some really leaning heavily into the academic side. It's this nice sort of marriage of the two, which is what you would expect at a institution like ours where people live in community, an academic community, so...
Can you talk a little bit about that transition? So you went from these coffee house performances, the Brown Coffee House, to the collective. So what is the difference between the two, and how does the collective work? How do y'all find the artists? How do you decide who to bring here, and what does that process look like?
Well, Josh, you know, so
that's a good question.
Yeah, I was really leading the charge with what we were doing in the Commons. And it's a lot of work to do just to plan one show, much less six shows in a year. Sure. And then when we switched to the Live Music Collective, I knew that it was just not sort of the Commons thing or kind of mostly my thing. I really wanted to incorporate a whole lot of more voices on campus into it. And luckily, Josh and I had this radio show, and he got very interested and was like, hey, I can help you do some of this too. So that's kind of how we made the transition. And one of the other big transitions was that we started looking at the campus and the community as a whole in terms of like opportunities for and places for people to perform, and not just thinking about who can we put in 110 Broad Street. It really kind of opened things up in a lot of interesting ways. Hmm. I feel like I'm talking a lot. I feel like I should let Josh say something about how we're identifying artists these days.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and I should say, you know, connecting it back to the Commons, I came to campus in 2017, and, you know, Jeff and Mary are running the Commons. I had heard about Jeff and Mary's house shows. It was one of the first people I heard about when I arrived of like, oh, have you heard about these house shows? You have to hear about them. I think I may have attended one or two. Jeff invited me on his radio show, which was Getting Down with Brown Commons. And I think a lot of, you know, the brainstorming around the collective was between, you know, songs and commercials. We started talking about what this would look like, incorporating kind of town and gown relations, thinking about what different venues would look like on campus. And I have to say, there's a role for WRCU here, too, as of course we're on the air, but, you know, students are in the station all the time. So getting a sense of what music they're into, they have wonderful rotations that we can tap into. And there's a lot of people who are interested in playing music, listening to music on this campus. So really, I think it's us kind of listening to people we know. People send us recommendations all the time, and we're welcome to that. And then it really comes down to identifying artists that, A, can come to campus. Not everyone is touring through Central New York at all times. Certainly cost is a factor. But also we want to make sure that we bring in artists which are diversifying, you know, musical genres on campus too. So we want to bring in a range of artists and make sure that, you know, the crowd also enjoys the shows that we bring in, which I think they do quite a bit.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a community develop, mm-hmm. An audience develop for a lot of the shows that we're doing, which is exciting because it's taken a long time to really get people's attention and say, hey, this is a thing, and this is an opportunity for you to either see somebody that you want to see, that you know of, or learn about somebody that's an excellent musician, but you otherwise may not have thought to go see them.
Hmm. So. Can you give an idea of the breadth of performers that have come to campus, and how many different events have you all had?
I knew that question was going to come.
Yeah, how many in total?
Approximately.
I like the number. Well, when we were doing the Brown Commons Coffee House shows, by the time it was all over, we had nearly 30.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was a lot. To look back on and see that list of names is a little shocking.
And I think we've had, I want to say, at least 20 through the collective. And so together, if you consider those kind of a continuum, that'd be like 50-plus artists coming to campus.
Yeah. Some we've doubled up on.
Yeah, some we've doubled up on.
One, Amethyst Kia, for instance. Mm-hmm. We had Amethyst perform in 110 Broad Street in March 1st of 2018, I think, because we had this huge snowstorm the next day, and she had to stay an extra day. And then Amethyst came back having been nominated for a Grammy, and we used the Earlville Opera House for that performance and had almost a full house for that show. So, so it's not distinct, but almost a 50 distinct artists, I think.
Yeah, and the range, I mean, so to counter that, you have Amethyst Kia, and then you've got a band like Soul Glow, which is a hardcore punk band out of Philadelphia. And so that gives you a sense of kind of the range, and we're everywhere in between, right? So we bring in singer-songwriters. A show that sticks out in my mind would be the Nora Brown show that we did at Fojo, which was an afternoon show. Wonderful. She's a pretty young, I keep saying she's young, she might not be young anymore, she might be in her early 20s, banjo player.
It was 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I think at the time that Nora was here, she was 17.
Yeah.
Wow. So she's 19 and she's now at Yale.
Yeah, she was actually touring campuses. So Jeff gave her and her mother a campus tour. Doubling up for the live music collective.
Was not successful. Yeah. We did not yield Nora Brown.
You didn't put a hard enough push on.
But I think we hopefully were close.
Yeah.
I don't know. But she's a banjo player, you know, and it's really uncommon for a young person growing up in Brooklyn to pick up the banjo and learn from really old-time banjo players that had learned when they were growing up in Kentucky. And her parents were really supportive, and she traveled to West Virginia and Kentucky and learned directly from some of these old banjo pickers. She's an old soul.
Yeah.
trapped in a 19-year-old's body now.
And I think, too, of that show in particular, going back to what Jeff said of getting students involved, Jacob, who was one of our students and one of our pretty early devotees, Live Music Collective, at that show, he was tasked with selling Nora Brown's merch. Jacob has since graduated, but Nora Brown recently appeared on NPR's Tiny Desk, and Jacob tweeted out, like, I sold albums for Nora Brown back at Fojo when I was on. It's really interesting now to see students who have moved on and still keep that connection. And obviously, that's super memorable, right? If you're in college, you have this experience to interact with an artist or like set up a stage, sell merch, like that's going to stick with you. And I think Jacob will probably take that with him the rest of his life.
Yeah. Hopefully we're having lots of experiences like that with
students.
One of the recent, we had a rock band show, and it's a stretch for us to have an actual rock show, because there's a lot that goes into that, and those things are loud and big performances. But we had Wednesday, this band that is really just skyrocketing at the moment, and the New York Times had them in their top 10 albums.
They were everywhere.
And so they performed here at the Palace. The night before, they were in Brooklyn had a sold out show at Brooklyn Steel, which has space for 1,800 people, I think. And so we've got shows like that students, I think, also are going to look back on and be like, oh, I got to see Wednesday when they came through Colgate. So that's one of the things we're excited about, being able to give students the opportunity to see those bands that are on their way up. And so that one day they'll be like, oh, yeah, Colgate had a pretty good live music scene back in the day, and I got to see these people.
Before. Yeah, it makes me think about, we hear about alumni talk quite a bit about some of the old shows that have been here. Like there's like the Grateful Dead shows, like the legendary shows people talk about.
Springsteen supposedly was here.
Yeah, Aretha Franklin. Bob Marley played campus. There was a run, I think, in the 70s where it was like Fleetwood Mac, Springsteen, Bob Marley, like just an incredible run in the mid-70s of like really great acts. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I guess one of the things we haven't talked about is it is the Live Music Collective.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to emphasize live, because in our current moment where students typically walk around all the time with their headphones on, many of them feel like, oh, you know, I just like listening to music by myself with these headphones on. And we're trying to push back a little bit against that because there's something really special about the shared experience you have with a bunch of other human beings standing in at a rock show, you know, jumping around to some pretty loud music. That's a memorable experience, and it's something that brings people together. And I hope one of the things that we're doing with the collective is using live music to build community.
You guys were talking about some of the places that these shows have been. I noted a few of them are not on campus. Some are in the Village. One was in Earlville. Can you tell me about the different venues that you've had these events, how you pick the venue, and also what is the universe? So are you constantly looking for creative places for new shows?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're always looking for new venues. Again, when we were kind of brainstorming this, one thing to think about with a campus in a town is we immediately think of every building. Could that hold a concert? So, you know, we've ranged from, as we've mentioned, Fojo to Flower and Salt to the Palace Theater. And, you know, really, I think it's matching the venue with the artist. I think that probably leads our discussion most. So when you have a singer-songwriter, Flower and Salt's kind of the perfect place for that. It's an intimate setting. The way we set up the chairs, the closeness of that show. When you bring in a gigantic rock show like Wednesday, obviously now we're not going to squeeze them into a bakery, right? So we've kind of transformed, and a lot of people on campus have done this. Hall of Presidents, that's kind of one of our bigger venues. And then, you know, the Palace Theater is also kind of a perfect built-in venue for a big rock show. So I think that's kind of how we make our decisions on venues.
Yeah, they're kind of genre-specific. Like, we know what's going to be a good place given the genre and the musician. And if is it a one-person singer-songwriter, or is it a whole band that we need to accommodate with a stage or something like that? Like Amethyst Kia at the Earlville Opera House was just kind of like the perfect setting. There's a proscenium stage there, and it seats about 300 people. And the acoustics are perfect. It doesn't get any better than that. And doing those types of shows is just really good relationship building stuff for the university. Like, we now have a really good working relationship with the folks at the Opera House. We have a good working relationship with the folks at the Palace. The folks at Flower and Salt, Brendan and Britty, for folks out there, most people who listen to this podcast may have been to town. If they've been to town, they've probably gone to Flower and Salt. You know, they're alums. And they're really into music, of course, and they've been so supportive and such excellent collaborators in this project.
If someone wanted to learn about the music that's coming up, where would they go? How would they find out when these shows are going to be, or when these shows are going to be?
Yeah, the two main places I think to look are ColgateLiveMusicCollective.org is our website, and we keep that updated with both an archive of the artists that we've had. So if you want to peek at who's come to campus. Also gives you an idea of who's coming by semester, so fall and spring. We also have an Instagram account, which I think most students interact with, which is Colgate Live Music. And you can go there and we get updates, teasers. That's where we kind of give out early teasers of what's to come. So that's probably the best place. And as well, we do a Colgate Campus Calendar. We put acts there. And then we've also been posting things to CNY Arts, that organization. So, you know, again, broadening our circle to the community. Next Door Hamilton is a place. We post a lot. We think a lot about marketing, both on campus and beyond. That itself can be a full-time job, too.
Yeah, and it's still a challenge, right? it's still a challenge to get these shows in front of people, because I know I have conversations and folks are like, oh, I didn't know that was going to happen. And I'm always like, well, what do we need to do to reach these people that we know are interested and would love to come out for a show? So if you have any ideas.
That sounds like a good piece for Hello Hamilton.
There should
be a list in there.
Yeah.
It's the local newsletter for folks listening that don't live in Hamilton, but it's delivered locally.
Yeah, and we work really hard to try and have our lineup for the semester done before the semester begins, so we can kind of like have an announcement, like this is going to be our list of shows for say, the spring or for the fall.
Well, we need to talk about that. Yeah. That's perfect. That's exactly the kind of
And if anyone listens to From the Stacks to the Stars on WRCU 3 to 5 p.m. on Thursdays, which would be our show, we talk about our shows, I think, weekly, right? Like, we both look back and forward almost every week. So if anyone is listening to that radio station, and you can access it on, you can get a pretty good preview of what's to come.
Yeah, those are kind of like our public service announcements.
We don't get a lot of plugs on the podcast, so this is nice. It's something different.
It all weaves together.
Yeah. It's cool.
3 to 5, at least this semester. I think 4 to 6 is our typical time slot. Yeah. There was a little snafu.
We'll move back to our regular scheduled programming.
Yeah. From the Stacks to the Stars, though. I do appreciate that name, and Josh came up with that.
Yeah. So the callback to how does a physicist meet up with, you know, a librarian. That's kind of it, right? Like, it was the radio station having these conversations and then evolving from there. And I will say, you know, Jeff and I also may come from different musical backgrounds. So it's really interesting that we work together in the collective, and people remark on this all the time.
You're not squarely in the Americana world.
No, and you're not squarely in the hardcore metal scene. So it's really interesting to see these two personalities come together.
That's great. Music unites.
Yes, that's right.
Curious how this might tie into, Jeff, what you're doing. I know that you're working on something, this Dark Skies event, and maybe you can take a minute to talk about that and if there is a live music connection.
Yeah, well, there certainly is. Well, the Dark Skies thing comes from my sweet family chair. So the endowed chair that I was awarded almost 2 years ago now was based on some scholarship that I want to do related to dark sky preservation in Appalachia, and actually anywhere in general. But Appalachia happens to be a place that still has some fairly unpolluted skies east of the Mississippi and fairly accessible by some of the major population centers over here on the East Coast. So for a long time, I've been interested in doing some of this work back home because I happen to be from the southern part of West Virginia in the heart of the coal fields. And this was just a really natural connection for me to make. And so one of the things that I envision coming out of some of this work is perhaps a book or an edited volume of essays that deal with this issue, but not just from an astronomer standpoint, but from a multidisciplinary standpoint. Music could definitely be one of them. Music that is composed where people are inspired by things that they've seen in the sky, or songwriters that are writing about things where they bring in these elements or make references to the stars. Anything like that, musically speaking, I think really falls into the realm of what I'm interested in exploring with this project. So towards this goal of eventually having maybe an edited volume, I've put together this symposium with the help of a lot of friends like Mike Laranthi, who teaches Core Appalachia with me, has been helping me to organize some of this this symposium. So the symposium is planned for April 4th through the 6th. And I've invited a whole bunch of speakers. Some of them folks out there may have heard on this podcast, actually, because Anthony Avini, who's emeritus professor of all things at Colgate. I think he was in four different programs, including physics and astronomy. He'll be talking about some archaeoastronomy stuff. I have a friend from Smith College, James Lowenthal, who's been fighting the good fight of dark sky preservation for years, like decades, is going to come and speak. Have some musician friends, many of whom have played at our house and been part of the Brown Commons Coffee House, are coming up. Many of them, surprisingly, make reference to the sky frequently in some of their songwriting. So they'll have a session, and then they'll be performing as part of a concert on Saturday night, which is April the 6th, at the Palace Theater. Part of that concert is also going to be a community square dance. So that's going to be a combination.
Coming in handy, finally.
It is really funny.
Interactive. Yeah.
It's really very funny that you say that, because if we did that in gym class, I don't remember it.
I definitely did.
Line dancing.
I think it's a New York state requirement or something, I'm guessing.
But everybody else did it,
really?
Right? And everybody else I know is not from West Virginia or the heart of Appalachia. They're all from like these peripheral places, and they all did some square dancing and stuff growing up in class. And if we did it, I just didn't think anything of it because I don't remember doing it.
Well, maybe you're supposed to learn at home in West Virginia. Like, you know, that's a different thing.
Maybe. It was around, right? So that's one of the things that we're doing, one of the major things that we're doing with music in terms of the symposium. But I have poets coming in. I have a poet from Berea College who's coming and bringing students. And she's taken her students out to the middle of nowhere and had them sit and just look at the sky and then write about their experience and write poems about their experience. I have my high school English teacher coming to talk about some literature. Our keynote speaker is Ann Pancake, who is one of the best known Appalachian authors right now, an award-winning Appalachian author. And who else is a highlight? Oh, Crystal Good, who is a poet from West Virginia, is going to come up and present. And from on campus, I have one of the psychologists who studies birds and the effects of light pollution on birds is going to come and present some of their research.
Nice.
So it is really multidisciplinary. It comes from some in the sciences, some in the humanities, even a little bit into the social sciences. I have a couple of political scientists coming up from University of Tennessee, Knoxville, who's interested in developing, in terms of like an economic development program, developing a dark sky trail through Appalachia. Because astrotourism is actually a real thing. And places that have really nice dark skies can be destinations for people to go who are interested in getting to see the Milky Way without having to go, you know, really, really far away to see it. And, I guess I should say people who can't go out into their backyard and see the Milky Way will have to go to places to seek it out. Hmm. And so that's become a tourism driver.
Nice. And that same weekend is April 5th, 6th, is also Arts, Creativity, and Innovation Weekend. Is there a tie-in there as well?
Well, it's accidental.
No, it was intentional,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's sort of accidental, but it's a good tie-in. There's so much stuff that is part of the arts that's going to be involved in the symposium. The timing, other than making campus a little bit crazier than it was already going to be, there's a good tie-in to some of the arts and creativity stuff. One of the things that we're doing that's not necessarily musically related, on Friday night we're having a star party that is also open to the public. That dance and concert that I mentioned on Saturday night, also free and open to the public. Everything that we're doing, with the exception of the banquet, because it has to be limited to a certain number of people, is going to be free and open to the public.
That's great.
So there's a star party on Friday night. We're featuring Perry Ground, who is a Haudenosaunee storyteller, who's coming to tell star stories. And we'll be up on campus up above the new residence halls, Burke and Pynchon, looking at the sky. We'll have some telescopes set up, maybe some fires burning, and Haudenosaunee storyteller telling us all about what the indigenous folks thought about the sky and how they passed down those stories from generation to generation based upon the stories that they were able to tell by looking at the sky.
That's great. I like it. If someone, faculty, staff, or student wanted to get involved with the collective, what do they need to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. They can reach out to me or Jeff. We also have the Live Music Collective at colgate.edu email. Just send an email and basically express your interest. And many folks have done that, from individual shows to students reaching out to learn more about contracting, as Jeff said, getting interested in the industry. I have a student right now who I CC on all my correspondence with agents because they kind of want to see behind the scenes. And though, you know, there are many ways to get involved, from, you know, creating posters to literally just attending shows or helping us decide who to bring in. We're, again, the collective is truly a wide umbrella, and we're pretty open and flexible with it. So we welcome any and all.
Yeah. You know, I feel, and I think at some point I've kind of had to embrace this, that Josh and I sort of are really kind of pushing things along. But I would really like it to be truly more of a collective where we just kind of pass the baton around to folks. And I think Josh gets a lot of credit for introducing this Jazz in the Library series that we've started hosting. And also we have a Tiny Desk-ish sort of concert series now in the WRCU, maybe not the studio, but in the spaces
the station,
down there,
yeah.
In the station. And those things now we hope will kind of take on lives of their own that are sort of part of the collective, but really like the students in the radio station start to take a little bit more ownership of those shows that happen down there. And I think we have some folks that are seriously interested in jazz and have them take over more of the ownership of the Jazz and Library series. And that way we do start to function a little bit more as a collective. Our ideas about faculty being involved was really just to maintain this thing from year to year.
Gotcha.
Because, you know, most of the things that are so student-driven can kind of run in very cyclical patterns.
Someone graduates.
Yeah. So we were hoping the faculty and the staff that would be part of this collective would just kind of provide some sort of, like, stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
So every year we know things are happening. But we really want students to get involved and take some ownership of a lot of things that we want to do.
And I think it's finally happening. And I'll say this on air. I'm not the most patient person. And I remember this conversation all the time with Jeff when we were first starting this. Jeff said to me, like, it takes a good, like, at least 5 to 7 years to, like, change the culture, right? Or to get something off the ground. Whereas I kind of want to see change immediately. So what, we're, I guess, kind of in our third-ish year?
This is our third year.
Third into fourth year? Yeah. And so, you know, the Jazz in the Library series is starting to go off on its own and be supported. That's great. the WRCU sessions. You're seeing the radio station take ownership of that. And it's wonderful because all Jeff and I did was really facilitate, like, this is kind of logistically how it works. And then once they got the blueprint down, go forth. It's great. Like, we just want more live music on campus, and we're happy to support anyone who wants to help push that forward.
Yeah, and I think the thing that needs to be said is that we can do this only because the president, Brian Casey, is willing to support it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a testament to Brian and how interested he is at promoting the arts, but then also how interested he is in live music. Mm. And I think the fact that he sees the value in live music that we see, that it is something that can be an extremely valuable component of a community. And eventually, you know, it's going to be something that students will look to when they're thinking about coming to a certain institution. They're like, does this community really get into music? Are there opportunities for me to perform if I'm a student that plays an instrument? Are there opportunities for me to go see people on campus that I would like to see perform? And so it is about changing the culture. And it's something at the moment that we couldn't do, you know, without the president's support. So we're thankful for Brian for lending us that support and hopefully continuing it, right? Because we don't really have at the moment the guarantee that we'll be continuing this moving forward. So it's a matter of us having Brian's support moving forward, but then also thinking about ways of how do we make this part of the culture? Where do we put this budget line, really, to put it in just the frankest and clearest terms? It's like, where does this budget line come from so that we know that every year the resources are available for us to host these shows?
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit, I don't know if it's premature or not, but what you folks are thinking about coming up? So do you have anything locked in, any shows you want to talk about that are going to be happening?
Yeah, the two shows that are coming up and I guess finishing out this semester, in addition to the Dark Skies Symposium, which I think you've got a pretty big roster of artists coming to campus. Sack to Zubel is playing March 28th on campus, and that'll be at the Palace Theater. And we actually are kind of just – that's a perfect example of where we could plug in and support many people who are supporting that show. That's an indigenous rock band out of Mexico. It's going to be a great show. And they're doing a residency all week. So they'll be around campus. They'll be on the air being interviewed. And we also have Monica Geraldo coming. It's a Colombian-based singer-songwriter. That's going to be at Flower and Salt April 25th at about 8 o'clock. It'll also be a great show. So that's another opportunity for folks if you want to dip your toe in, you're not ready to go to the Hall of Presidents with 300-plus students and listen to a rock band. Or a punk band from Philadelphia. Come on out to Flower and Salt and check that show out. Those are kind of the two we have finishing out, I think, this semester, unless there's a show you haven't told me about.
No, I think that's it. I think one of the things, the Community Square Dance and that concert, that's going to be a big happening.
Big capper, yeah.
Yeah, and just the participatory aspect of that, I'm really excited about, and I hope we get a bunch of students there, and I hope we get a bunch of community members there and have them all kind of square dancing together. That would be so great, in my opinion. Just bringing these two communities together in that type of a setting is really important.
Let's make sure there's video of that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've made it to question 13.
Oh,
so we're at the end here. And I always do something a little fun. And fun would be, if money wasn't an option, who would you want to bring to the who should the collective bring here if you each had your own choice?
I think it's Pitbull, right?
Yeah, it's clearly Pitbull. Which backstory there? We put out a poll to see who we should bring to campus, and there was a write your own option in, unfortunately, and people took advantage of that, and we can't tell if it was a joke or not, but Pitbull made it to the top. Needless to say, we can't afford. Wait,
so Pitbull was the number one write-in candidate. Was there a campaign?
I don't know, there might have been word of mouth. We talk about it often. Like, to be clear, I don't think we could afford Pitbull, but
Mr. Worldwide.
Yeah. Pitbull's not at the top of my list.
Yeah, who is at the top? I was trying to think. Can I deconstruct the question? Does this band have to be currently touring and exist, or if I could
they have to exist? Oh. So, okay, let me set up the parameters.
I already went down rabbit holes of bands that I'd like to bring back together and do a one-off performance.
Yeah, so. We're not resurrecting anyone. Bands that are currently touring or maybe will be touring or artists. It doesn't have to be a band, obviously. So if you had your choice of any living, breathing person that could come here?
Oh, Jeff knows my answer, so.
Well, I got mine. What's yours?
You could guess my band.
Local 8?
Yeah, that's it.
Nice.
That's a duo out of Chicago. Actually, we could afford them. So we could do this. This is a rock band out of Chicago, Illinois. My favorite band, I think, of all time. I would love to bring Local H to campus.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you one. I'm going to give you a second.
Hey, I didn't know we had two.
Well, who would be the other?
No,
be your second?
I think Local H would be it.
Man.
I was going to say Resurrect at the Drive-In, which is one of my favorite bands from El Paso, Texas. But they are defunct, and I don't think they'll get back together. But that would be my second choice.
So one of my goals with this whole thing is that eventually we will have a concert hall. Not a concert hall, like a little performance venue, but it's a recital hall. Something that seats about 250 people. Not a big concert hall that has like 800. I don't think we could use a space like that, actually. But the place that seats about 200, 250, it's really good acoustics. We could use a place like that. And so when we get that place, I want to invite Rhiannon Giddens.
Oh, yeah.
I want to invite Gillian Welch and David Rawlings. And, Bonnie Light Horseman.
Oh, yeah.
So all three.
Yeah, all three. Maybe at the same time.
And then at the same time.
And then we'll have like a community square dance or something.
It's an interesting question because I will say, for me, I think we kind of brought one of my dream artists in. The Valerie June show that we had, I think both of us had Valerie June pretty high on our list. And I'm just still amazed that we got Valerie June to come to campus. And that show was great. She's such a wonderful human being. And yeah, that is probably my favorite concert of all time that we've done.
Yeah, and we had her kind of right as she was on the we got her right on the cusp.
Yeah.
She was becoming really popular at the moment. She was to date our most expensive act.
Yeah.
For sure. But then at that time she was up for a Grammy. Mm. And then I think she's been nominated for Grammys since. Maybe I should also include Allison Russell in that group of people that we would like to have. Talking about somebody who's been nominated for a bunch of Grammys.
So you want to bring in our native daughters. You just want to bring everybody in.
Pretty much.
Let's not leave
Layla McCall out. I just get all four of them. Folks out there may have no clue who we're talking about. Our Native Daughters was this group that Rhiannon Giddens had put together. And if folks out there have not heard of Rhiannon Giddens, she, on our radio show, on my old radio show, whenever I would mention Rhiannon Giddens, I would typically describe her as the most talented person walking the planet at the moment. I don't think there's much anything Rhiannon Giddens can't do. She was trained as an opera singer at Oberlin. She went to Oberlin to the conservatory, but then left there and got way into old-time string music and had a group called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. She went on. She's won a MacArthur Genius Award. She won a Pulitzer recently for an opera that she had written. There's really nothing that she can't do.
She's all over the new Beyonce album. So if you've never heard Rhiannon Giddens, you probably have if you've listened to the new Beyonce singles that have come out.
Yeah, the Texas Hold'em. Mm-hmm. That banjo at the beginning is Rhiannon Giddens.
Josh and Jeff, thank you so much for joining the show today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for letting us preach the gospel.
Yeah.
Of course.
Thanks,
tell your friends and family about the podcast. If you have any questions, feel free to email 13@colgate.edu. That's 13 the number. And until next time, keep asking questions. 13 is a production of the Colgate University Office of University Communications. Executive producer, L. Hazel Jack. Producer and host, Daniel DeVries. Audio production by Brian Ness. Learn about all the happenings at Colgate by visiting colgate.edu, colgatemagazine.com, and colgateresearchmagazine.com.